May it please the Court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, you can watch your clock there. I'll also try to help you.
Thank you. My name is Allison Guernsey, and I represent the defendant in this case, Mr. Williams. This is a case that's before the Court regarding the propriety of the evidence that the District Court relied upon in order to revoke Mr. Williams' term of supervised release. Mr. Williams came into federal court after pleading guilty via an Alford plea in Washington State Court. He pled guilty to an Alford plea whereby he maintained his factual innocence to a second-degree assault charge. This was also a bar plea, and in Ray Bar is a case in Washington State that allows an individual to plead to a legal fiction in order to take advantage of a plea deal or in order to minimize exposure under sentencing laws. When he came into federal court, he faced 3 supervised release violations, 2 of which were dismissed by the district court, and the only one that the court found had been proven by a preponderance.
Were they dismissed or just not reached? And didn't the judge decide, okay, I'm going to check this box, I don't need to consider the others?
My recollection is that his oral decision on the date of the hearing was that he was going to dismiss the allegation that there was a firearm as well as the association with a felon. He said several times in the record, I'm not inclined to find that Mr. Williams possessed a firearm, particularly because the second-degree assault charge to which he ultimately pled guilty, I'm sorry, the third-degree assault charge does not require a firearm. And my understanding was that he also declined to rule, or I'm sorry, dismissed the petition alleging that he associated with a felon.
Well, he says the court makes no finding as to the remaining violations. And in particular as to the felon, it suggests to me that okay, that's a factual question, but I don't have to go there because I've decided based on whatever it was that caused the state court conviction, that's enough for my purposes to satisfy the first. It potentially makes a difference because we accept your argument. There's a question as to what happens to the case from there. What do you say should happen to the case from there?
If the case were to be remanded to the district court, we would have an evidentiary hearing. I believe that the testimony as to the other violations has already been provided, as well as at least the defense has provided briefing on the meaning of the term associates. So the district court could, if he has not dismissed those other two, go back and rule on all 3.
Let me ask another question in terms of where we stand now. I think you told us in our brief that his expected release date is earlier this month. Has he been released?
He has been released. He has.
And he's no longer under supervision.
He is not.
What's left?
Certainly. There actually is an implication here because the finding of a violation and the imposition of an 18-month sentence has the potential, assuming he commits another crime in the future, to increase his guideline range. For example, his underlying conviction, he received a term of imprisonment. Because of his revocation, it's the date of his revocation that would be used to calculate criminal history score were he to commit another crime in the future in federal court in calculating his potential guideline range. So there is an impact. If it were to be remanded to the district court, and if the court were to find that there were no violations, he wouldn't have that subsequent sentence. Ergo, the date of the original conviction would be the date that was used in calculating his guideline range. So it does make a difference.
One of the things the district court said in its order is he acknowledged that the state could prove he had committed a crime beyond reasonable doubt. I read his statement a little bit differently. So I think he said, if you believed everything that the government put on, he was at risk for a conviction. So what effect does that have on your argument in terms of what the district court's understanding of what happened and what the actual statement was?
Well, I think Your Honor is correct. I think if you read on page 66 of the excerpts of record exactly what Mr. Williams said in his statement on a plea of guilty, it says he's pleading guilty to accept the offer of the state. I believe that he runs a substantial risk of being convicted. If a jury were to believe the state's evidence. And then again, when the state court went through the change of plea hearing with Mr. Williams, he again acknowledged merely that the state had evidence that, if believed by a jury, could result in a conviction.
Although I'm not even sure they did. This was a plea under the N. Ray Barr doctrine, is sort of an artificial crime?
I believe it's a plea both under Alfred and N. Ray Barr.
Yeah.
So he maintained factual innocence to the crime to which he ultimately pled guilty, but in order for that plea to be knowing and voluntarily given, the state court was required to find the factual basis for the greater charge under N. Ray Barr. But they're not mutually exclusive, and I think...
No, I know they're not mutually exclusive. It seems to me it compounds the inappropriateness of viewing this as a admission of factual guilt, which is what the district court took it to be.
I would agree with Your Honor.
I mean, this fiction, I guess, he entered an Alford plea and Barr plea to causing bodily harm with a weapon. Is that right? Is that what third-degree assault was under the Washington law?
There is no weapon.
I understand that, but that's what the crime was, correct?
That is correct. Negligence.
And there was no weapon, so he couldn't have executed such a crime, so to speak.
Exactly.
Now, I understand Washington law, of course, is different than California, where there actually is a statute that says that such a plea, an Alford plea, is basically tantamount to a guilty plea. We don't have that in Washington, correct?
That is correct.
Is there anything in Washington law that is contrary to your position? In other words, where the Washington courts have taken the position that even though it's maybe not exactly like a guilty plea, that it's more like a guilty plea of pleading guilt than anything else? Is there anything in Washington law that would lead us, that we should look at?
Not that I have found. The government does cite to the Washington rules of evidence that allow a Alford plea to be used in a probation hearing or in a sentencing hearing, but notably the government nor I have uncovered a case mm-hmm. where a Alford plea has been preclusive, or the facts establishing an Alford plea do not allow someone to attack it in a later sentencing hearing. And the cases that I have cited regarding sentencing hearings certainly involve a statute that requires that facts relied upon to impose a exceptional sentence must be admitted, verified, or proved. And we believe that, again, just supports our position that in Washington, the mere fact that someone enters an Alford plea doesn't mean that that factual basis has been admitted or proved.
Do you want to save the remaining time?
I would. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Alexander Ekstrom on behalf of the appellee, United States of America. Your Honors, to address Judge McCown's question first regarding the colloquy at the time of plea in the state court, that existed at excerpt of record 73 through 74. And the court is correct that the precise language used was the Superior Court judge asking the defendant whether the defendant believed that there was enough evidence to convict the defendant if the jury were to believe the evidence in the police reports. And there was an earlier conversation regarding the defendant's having reviewed the police report with his attorney. That's also included in the statement of plea of guilty. Your Honor.
Well, why should that end the question, though? I mean, that there's a big if there, if the jury should believe. So he has the prospect of going to trial. That's not what happened, but is concerned about the possibility the jury doesn't believe him, although he thinks or knows for a fact, because he's there, what the actual events were. Why should we disregard that difference?
Because in this case, a Alford plea is treated like a nolo contendere. The nolo contendere under Verduzco and Guadarrama is sufficient to show the violation of both supervised release and probation. And Washington...
Those are under California law, right?
Those are under California, specifically under Section 1016.
Right.
However, Washington uses the same structure in its evidentiary rules that the federal system uses. There is the general exclusion under 410, which mirrors the federal rule, and there is also the exception provision for miscellaneous proceedings in 1101D3 in the federal rule and 1101C3 in the state rule.
Well, that may tell me that a nolo plea is potentially admissible for consideration, but I think back, why is it that a nolo plea is not, under the rules of evidence, I think both Washington State and federal, is not admissible when the rules of evidence do apply? What's the logic behind that? Well, it seems to me the logic is that it's not sufficiently compelling or probative. Well, if it's not sufficiently probative, why should we turn around and say in a supervised release hearing it's a given?
Because of the case law that indicates that the inquiry in a supervised release hearing is different in species, and the government has cited to Miller, mm-hmm. at 514 F. 2nd, 41 at 43.
What makes the evidence any more reliable? I mean, the effect here is that you've got somebody going to jail for, 18 months, which is usually what happens as a result of a criminal prosecution. This is evidence that wouldn't be admitted in a criminal prosecution. Why should we accept it as conclusive in the context of this miscellaneous proceeding?
Because the nature of the evidence doesn't change, however, the nature of the inquiry does. And that's the government's argument, that even after Crawford, we're not looking at a Sixth Amendment right of confrontation, but rather a Fifth Amendment due process under Hall. If the copy of the conviction is sufficient and under Garcia, and the defendant can't collaterally attack the conviction under Carrion, in that case, using the same evidentiary rules that brought the federal courts to the conclusion under their rules of evidence, the Washington State rules are the same.
But we said that there's where it seems to me you're trying to conflate admissibility with probity. And it's one thing to say it could be admissible. Admissible for what? Well, it's admissible for whatever it's worth. That's like any piece of evidence. So I'm not sure that gets you the last 20 feet.
I understand the court's question. And and my answer is that under Verduzco and Guadarrama, it is not only admissible, but the court indicates that it would be sufficient to find the violation.
Certainly under California law.
Certainly under California law, and certainly under federal law.
But we're in Washington.
Right, and the government's argument is that for the same reason that those two rules of evidence work in conjunction to make it an appropriate response under the federal rules of evidence, that is compelling.
I'm not
evidence.
Sure it's the same under federal law. The Verduzco, however it's pronounced, forgive me, and Guadarrama relied on California Penal Code Section 1016, which provided that the legal effect of a nolo contendere plea to a crime punishable as a felony, quote, shall be the same as that of a plea of guilty for all purposes. I don't know of any federal equivalent of that.
No, Your Honor, the federal system resolves it in the way that I described. However, Washington has a definition of conviction under RCW 9940030 sub 9 to include an adjudication of guilt pursuant to Title 10 or 13, the juvenile statute, including a verdict of guilty, finding of guilty, or acceptance of plea of guilty, with no distinction made between the mechanism by which the plea is taken, be it nolo contendere, Alfred, Barr, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Another thing that is odd here, and this maybe even bothers me more than the difference between Alfred, nolo, et cetera, is the Washington peculiarity of In re Barr. So under the federal statute, the government needs to show by a preponderance that he committed a crime, correct?
That there was the commission of a crime, federal, state, or local.
Right. And so the crime which we're focusing on now is this assault in the third degree, correct?
Correct.
But we know he didn't commit that.
Well, Your Honor,
didn't the prosecutor even say that in the very pages you were referencing us to earlier, that I think he said the elements don't match up?
The prosecutor did say that. However, a weapon includes a firearm. Weapon is a broader term that would include. I don't know that necessarily the prosecutor is factually correct.
Well, but it has to include bodily harm under the third degree.
Yes.
In Washington.
No.
You're just certainly not your fault that you landed in the middle of two peculiarities, okay?
But I find myself here.
You are here. And the one, though, that it does bother me that you can make up this fiction and then, and we know he didn't do that. Whatever he didn't do that. And now that, meaning the third degree assault, which everyone agrees is a total fiction, has become a basis for which we can say he committed that crime by preponderance of the evidence. Something doesn't sit right with that, so dig me out of the hole.
Your Honor, the only thing I can offer to the court is the original statement in Barr, which I concede is not further discussed in Zuaro or the other case cited by the defense, where at 716, the court says, we hold that when, as here, the record establishes a factual basis for the two crimes originally charged, there were two crimes in that instance, mm-hmm. and reveals, quote, the defendant's understanding of his complicity of the crimes. And there is that language that exists in Barr that it does not exist in Alfred or Newton, which is the Washington equivalent. And again,
when he took his plea, whatever kind of plea it was he advised that even though you're denying guilt, even though the charge is actually an artificial one, and even though this is a classic sort of deal to deal with the overall situation, by the way, you face imprisonment, potential imprisonment in federal court as a consequence of this plea.
He was not advised of that collateral consequence. He was advised of the fact that he faced a potential of maximum of 5 years in the state court as a result of that. So he was advised of a substantially severe penalty, but there are many collateral consequences of which he was not advised. Mm. Did I answer the court's question?
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you.
Your Honor, I find that I have 30 seconds less, and so I ask the court if there are any further questions of me.
It appears not. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would just like to make one final point in response to the government. The section that the government read from In re Barr, talking about the defendant's understanding of his complicity in the crime, it would be our position that that simply doesn't mean that the defendant is agreeing that he has committed that crime, but rather because In re Barr talked about the voluntariness of a plea, that simply goes to whether the entry of a plea is voluntary in that he understands the evidence that would be presented were he to go to trial. And unless the panel has further questions, I would yield the remainder of my time.
No further questions. Thank you both for your arguments. You know, it falls in the category of you can't make this up. We appreciate both the briefing and the arguments. The case of United States versus Williams is submitted.